Hey, welcome to another Lorenzo's Music Show. I talked today with an artist that I played on one of our Creative Commons music shows that we do on Spotify. They actually have tons of different types of music that they put out. The one that I played was more industrial-like, and we talk about that, but they also have kind of an early 80s, late 70s sort of funk sound that they release. They do trance music. Some of their tracks are like 20 minutes long. Some of them are short. Some of them have vocals. Some of them don't. But they have their own home studio, and we talk about the gear. They have an entire room full of gear all hooked up that they're recording in this home studio that they created. And it was just really fun to meet the person, another Creative Commons musician like us, and just talk shop, talk gear, talk about the music that they put out. So here's that interview starting right now.
My name is Daniel Glasscock. I am a musician of several decades at this point, I guess.
Yeah.
Primary projects include everything under the Orbs umbrella. So Oxford Road Basement Studios. We've got Love Undulates, Violently Consciousness Rises Above Fear is my primary project. Got Hypermortal, a band, more psychedelic metal stuff. Softcore Syndicate, Goofy Funk Music, and Serene Fiend is also a band that we've been pretty active in the live scene around here with, which is more of an industrial synth rock type thing.
When you say more active, are you saying that you've been playing out or you've been releasing stuff?
It's just sort of compartmentalized. So most of the live music since COVID that I've done has, actually all of it, I mean, aside from one instance, was with Serene Fiend. And okay. It's more of a, it's definitely something that live is, it's more of a live experience, because a lot of the stuff that I do and with other people is more of an introspective styled music. It's not this bombastic, you know, explosive thing. And Serene Fiend's definitely like you're at a rock show.
Okay.
So that's kind of what differentiates it in my mind. But it used to be we'd grind a lot on with the sort of the metal circuit. Mm-hmm. And then that's sort of how we cut our teeth as musicians. But bar scene, I'm not into it.
Right.
I'm not into a lot of live venues just by nature of the atmosphere of the whole thing, which is just drunk people yelling at you and spilling things on your pedal board, and you get paid $17 at the end of the night.
That part I don't like, but the other part I don't have a problem with. I do hate the getting paid $17 part though. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's fun when you're just playing out with your friends and stuff, but like, God, I'm exhausted and I got to go to work tomorrow and I'm getting old and, you know, all these, you know, adulty reasons why you just throw in the towel eventually. But I think in little spurts, it's a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
To go, you know, hump all that gear up on stage and crank it up as loud as possible and, you know, kick your feet and scream and have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's a time and place for it in my mind.
I remember when I originally started playing in bands when I was in fourth grade. And I chose, I've been doing it for a while, not successfully since fourth grade, but I started in fourth grade. You know, we would play for like the neighborhood kids. I think the first couple of songs we knew was Sunday Bloody Sunday and Rock You Like a Hurricane.
Oh, nice. You know, that's a good repertoire.
That's a good
for
mixture,
fourth grade.
Right?
You're doing better than the whole lot of high schoolers and college age people I know, that's for sure.
And I chose to be the singer. I didn't even consider whether or not I could sing. I chose to be singer because all I needed to get was a microphone in my mind. So, you know, forgetting like PAs and all the other stuff that comes with it, but also because like what you said, I wouldn't have to lug gear. And then later on in life, it's like, oh, I know, I'll start playing instruments along with singing. So I'm not just standing there and now I have to lug gear. Although I help out anyway. I mean, you gotta.
Well, yeah, you want to pitch in. It's a communal effort.
Yeah.
But man, a lot of like the last few years before COVID hit, where we were kind of winding down the live thing, was so much me just struggling to find a methodology to justify bringing gear on stage. So it's like, if I could find a smaller amp, if I could find a smaller keyboard, if I could find a lighter bass, you know, if I could find a smaller pedal board, and you know, it's a zero sum game. I mean, like
Well, and when you're
you're either
saying
going to
all
be all
that, when you're
around.
saying that, you're talking about like you having that, or are you saying the rest of the band? Like, because I know you have a lot of gear.
Oh,
I've seen
yeah. I mean,
photos.
like I said, we started doing like metal music. Metal people didn't like us, but we were very loud and you know, very big amps, you know, big stoner doom amps, Suns and Avatars and Sovtechs and that sort of thing. And it's hard on your back, you know?
Yeah.
So I'd just pare it down and pare it down. And then we got sort of into synthesis, live synthesis mixing with it. And, but still too heavy. It's still too much crap between a drum set and a bass and a guitar and all these amps and stuff.
Right. Yeah. And where is this now? I just realized I didn't even ask where you're located.
Lawrence, Kansas.
Kansas. Okay. So you were doing all this in Kansas. What is the scene like in Kansas?
Well, broader Kansas, there's not much of one.
Okay.
Lawrence has always kind of had a big thing going on for us. I mean, you know, back in the 90s, a lot of people would like to conflate the thing and be like, oh, this is like the Seattle of the Midwest. And, oh, because Kurt Cobain came and visited William S. Burroughs here. And there's all these, and we had
the
outhouse.
He recorded Nevermind Where I Am, so I'm in Madison.
Oh, in Madison? No way. I didn't know that.
So competition met.
Well, we have the outhouse, which is our big DIY claim to fame. Because you know, everybody played there back in the day, and it was chaos. And, you know, it was Hell's Angels running security there, and people shooting AK-47s while the band is throwing up. You know, and like it's pretty legendary. That's our, you know, big piece of music history, I think.
Okay.
But it's a thriving scene. I you know, since COVID, you know, all live music feels like it's taken a kind of a downturn. Like the bands who really, really want to play, they're going out there and they're doing it. But the casual folks who would just throw a band together for a month or two, you don't see much of that anymore. And especially in the college, there's not a whole lot of performing musicians that are like in a synergized setting. It's a lot of solo acts and a lot of like DJ work.
Okay.
So, I mean, Kansas City's doing pretty good. Lawrence has always kind of had a steady scene with Replay Lounge and the Bottleneck, two local venues. Get a lot of big acts through there. So,
all right.
And it's I'd say a moderately good scene.
Okay. And I want to talk about the different types of bands that you've been mentioning, because this might actually clear up some things for me. So the way that I found out about your music is one, I do, we're a Creative Commons band, and I have a show where I play Creative Commons music, and I had found your stuff and it was released under Creative Commons. So I played it. And one of the songs was, I want to say, first of all, it was pronounced Gin Boogie.
Yeah. Just a misspelling, but Gin. But
there's a J in both words is the way that you did it.
Yeah.
And that was under the, and I can't even, so we have an abbreviation of your name that thank God you use, which is Lovecraft. but otherwise it was under the long name, which is Love Undulates Violently.
Consciousness Rises Above Fear.
Okay. And I thought it was Love Undulates Violently is greater than, because you use a greater and than symbol in between the two phrases.
I mean, you could put that. Yeah.
Because I was like, then it's even longer than what you're telling me.
It's just, I thought it looked cool.
Yeah, no, it does.
It means nothing.
And I love the fact that the abbreviation looks like Lovecraft, kind of like the Bad Brains, or no, that's Soulcraft. Never mind. Okay. I was going to say like the Bad Brains song, but I had misremembered the Bad Brains song name.
Yeah. Lovecraft is a Mondegreen of H.P. Lovecraft, the author, which, and it kind of stemmed from the impulse of cosmic horror.
Okay.
But as my sound evolved and I was like placing more meaning and context on stuff, Lovecraft, the long thing, Love Undulates Violently, Consciousness Rises Above Fear, is kind of like my mission statement for how to approach reality in general. And of course, music as my undercurrent. I mean, it's my spiritual core.
Yeah.
So this is like how we should approach the universe in all of its scariness. It's like love will reign supreme, and in conscious thought directs the construction of reality.
Okay. Damn,
despite the darkness that fear that is always encroaching upon, trying to destroy our creative impulses, and long, very Brobdingnagian meaning, but I mean that's just sort of how I justify the whole thing.
Yeah. And that song that I played, now first of all, when I played this song, it kind of reminded me of like Front 242 or like, you know, late 80s, early 90s industrial music. And I dug
totally,
that.
Yeah.
But the thing was, is then I listened to some of the other songs and they're not all like that. And that's why I was like, with these different bands, you have a bunch of different styles even under the same project. So first of all, tell me about that song and the industrial influence on it.
Okay. So, that whole album, The Skinwalker, I've been doing a lot of albums that are kind of constructed around certain synthetic setups. So Skinwalker was made primarily with analog synthesizers and drum machines.
Yeah.
It was all the drums on it for the most part are done with a old Korg KR-55B, which was a drum machine that Depeche Mode used a lot, and a few other bands from the 80s, they blended into their drum sound. But I also wanted to make like some gritty acid style stuff. So it mostly used like a Moog Opus 3, the KR-55B, a Moog grandmother, semi-modular thing, and then like Prophet 5, a Solina, sort of standard classic, you know, big keys, and then a 303. And that, so it's like everything that I can make with those things without using MIDI was the intention of Skinwalker.
You didn't program any of that. You were playing it. Okay.
It's all played live. Of course it's edited in the studio and stuff and overdubs. But, the intention was to make it messy and to make it really dirty and gritty and degraded sounding. And I did a whole bunch of stuff in the mastering process to add to that texture, because I'm really into that. Mm-hmm. So Gin Boogie is kind of like a Drexia style rave type song for me. Drexia, or like early Warp Records people, Aphex Twin, Square Pusher, that sort of thing. So
nice.
That was the impulse with that one. I've done records before that are like, that almost sound more symphonic with a certain type of gear. Like I did an album with just a Roland JX3P and tried to make all the drum sounds with it, all of the pads and melodic blips and bloops, all just with this one keyboard. And then, so it's like a stylistic challenge for myself with a lot of the, you know, purely electronic music that I do.
Okay. What multi-track DAW are you using?
I'm Pro Tools.
Okay. All right. And then with the gear that you have, how long have you been collecting this gear? I want to know more about this gear that you have. You post pictures of different types of gear all the time. And I'm sure I'm only seeing like a third of it.
Yeah. I like to brag, you know, whenever I come across a new
rightfully
piece.
Rightfully so.
Yeah. It's because like right at the end of before the pandemic, gear prices were still really low, especially on the used market for vintage stuff. Because even though there was still there was already the fetishization of vintage gear going on, there was also really cheap like plugins and alternatives on the market, and people were like getting rid of their old stuff because it was either broken or just trying to part it out or something, just get as much money as they can, because they can make that same sound with a computer or with a modern digital equivalent. And I was like, now this is my chance. I can buy this stuff up and fix it, you know, just get out a solder gun and look up the components list. And so I, you know, kind of taught myself to restore some of these synthesizers. And then what do you do with them? They just sit around and collect dust? No, of course you make some music with it.
Yeah.
So, and that I've kind of been riding that wave for about, a decade at this point, I guess.
All right.
Cause I got, when I got the time on my hands, I'm like, I want to make weird psychedelic sounds. Mm-hmm. So those things are just immediate gateways to that. Like psychedelia and funk, at its core, I think funk is psychedelia in a more pure syncopated jazz context. So like having all these keys, all these tools, it's like, wow. Just lights dancing everywhere. And that's kind of my bag.
Okay. And when you're setting up for an album, like what is the process when you're starting one of these songs? When you get an idea in your head, like you had mentioned you wanted to do an album like this or like that, do you research it? Do you just go with it and go, I think I know how it's done? I mean, what's the process for starting a project like that?
It's kind of like that. Yeah. Okay. Like, I don't know exactly what I want out of this, but it's going to fall into place, you know, like the manifestation thing, you know, like I sometimes have a really clear idea of what I want. Like mm-hmm. with that JX3P album, that one, I was like, I want this to sound beautiful. I want this to be like a really beautiful, serene type, formalist exercise. But with like other stuff where I like to set formalist rules, like just like I was talking about with Peter Greenaway, so much of his filmography is in a formalist setting. He mm-hmm. plays games with the medium. He'll play a numbers game. He'll play a lighting game, which will define the process and make it a cohesive piece of art simply by nature of directed study. Mm-hmm. So if you can create these formalist constructs for your music, sometimes it inspires things you never expected to do. And I find it's brought a lot of things out of me that I couldn't just sit down with a guitar with and do, mm-hmm. obviously. And I'm not a keyboard player.
You're not?
I can barely play keys. I can play chords and stuff, and I can, you know, occasionally do a run here and there.
Okay. But with the amount of synths that I've seen you post, I thought you were a keyboard player for sure.
Well, I mean, I play keyboards, but okay. I think if you were to ask anybody who had rudimentary piano playing knowledge, they'd be like, oh, that dude's a fraud.
Okay. All right. Well, then I'm pretty much in the same boat. Okay. I got you. I thought you were just saying that. You didn't play them at all. And I'm like, why do you have so okay, oh, no. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
No,
all
right. I play
then
them.
That's
play
me
them.
Too.
I play them, but they're not, it's not my virtuosic expertise.
Okay.
You know, I'm a bass player. I play bass really well. Mm-hmm. I sing, I think I sing pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I'm an all right songwriter. So it's like, to always, you know, David Bowie, he was like, always reach a little further than you think you're able to. And he's right. He's right 100% of the time. Always just reach a little far out of your depth. Always just go a little bit deeper into the pool. Mm-hmm. And you know, just whenever you're uncomfortable enough thinking like, I can't do this, that's whenever you're like on the verge of the coolest thing you've ever done. And that's happened to me like time and time again, you know, as an ethos.
Yeah. Most people would think back in the day, they would say, well, he shouldn't have thought that when he did Tin Machine, but I liked Tin Machine. So I was happy when he did that. I actually enjoyed that album.
Yeah. Me too. I mean, like, I don't know. I'm a little more forgiving with really like avant-garde mm-hmm. type stuff. And now that I'm getting older, I feel like I'm way more forgiving with like sort of like adult contemporary stuff. Cause it's like, you know, they wanted to just refine it and like smooth it over a little bit better. Cause that's just part of getting older. I feel like is like, you want to take some of the hard edges off of it and like make it a little more texturally rich and maybe a little more extravagant or maybe just dial it in more. I mean, I'm speaking so broadly here though. So.
Right. Well, now you were talking about your songwriting process. And then what I want to know is when you are songwriting, there are some songs you have, or maybe it's just one or two, but they're like 20 minutes long.
Oh yeah.
So how do you, I mean, I understand how you can do that, but you've released it like that. And one question I have is like, so writing a 20-minute tune, are you actually overdubbing that, like multi-tracking, or is it just something that you do in one setting? It's sort of freeform. Like, how are you going about those longer songs?
It's a mixture of it. Like for instance, okay, I have like procedural bovine tissue extraction by interdimensional entities.
Okay.
That one is about 28 minutes long. It was mostly pieced together from some isolated bass synth jams from a different jam of with live musicians, and then a full sit down with a Prophet Rev 2, and I just played for 28 minutes.
Okay.
And I sculpted the sound with the filters and envelopes and stuff. I'd hold a couple keys or whatever and just like let it ride out and create this landscape with the music. And then I'd maybe go back and do another overdub of that interplaying with the original 28 minute part. And if there was a little thing in there, and there always is, if there was a little thing in there where like I closed the filter too quick, okay, or I turned up the noise too much, I'll just go in and edit it a little bit and smudge it or whatever. And that adds to the psychedelia of the thing.
Yeah.
But then there's other tracks where, man, you know, I'll do 8 hours, like in an augmented state, I'll do about 8 hours of playing. Mm-hmm. And I take like that's for like Ontological Fallacies 1989. That one was about, I think I did the majority of the tracking of that over the course of 7 straight hours.
Come on now. Really?
Yeah.
Damn, son.
I don't remember some of it because it was like sort of a trance-like state for me.
Yeah.
I did it over the course of a night. So I pulled an all-nighter and it was kind of like ecstatic, you know, probably not the healthiest thing to do, but I mean, because I don't remember some of it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
But then I edited it down and I chopped it down and chopped it down. And like, I found, oh, this is that morsel of the song. And then I just go back through and do another like 20 minute take over it. And maybe add some textures from drum machines fading in and out and effects pedals and stuff. It's all exploratory and there's no pressure on those types of compositions. Like it's whatever you want to make of it. So there's no payoff to it aside from just you get to sit in this landscape for a while. It's not like a chorus where you get this is the best part. Oh, and then the drop. Yeah. No, there's none of that. So you don't have to adhere to a formula.
I love the fact that somewhere you have with these songs, a Zack Snyder cut of
what you did. Oh, God. You do not want to hear the Zack Snyder cut of Ontological Fallacies 1989.
But
believe me,
the other thing too is, do you ever consider live streaming these? Because that sounds like something that would be perfect for like a Twitch live stream or a YouTube live stream where you're doing these things.
That. Yeah, I've considered that, but also like, I don't know, I feel like there's still a part of it that's private to me. And you know, as much as I want to like get it out and like let people enjoy it, if they're even into it, I've been a pretty bad marketer all my life in terms of like music. So like with that though, it feels like, you know, the particle beam duality thing where like you observe a particle and it changes its behavior in physics. I kind of feel that, you know, sneaking suspicion that music is the same way. Like whenever you have somebody watching you, or whenever you're in a collaborative state with other people where they're watching you too and listening to you actively, that changes the way you play and it changes what you create. Mm-hmm. So in a completely isolated state where a lot of that stuff comes from, like the really desolate textures and landscapes and all that sort of thing, I feel like you really have to be completely unwatched, you know, like you're the bear taking the shit in the woods. I love if that you catch analogy. My drift.
Yeah, I do. It's funny because we have the exact opposite thing, whereas I started live streaming our songwriting sessions because it forces us to dick around less. So what it is it's like we run with an idea and it's like keep rolling with it because we can't stop and go, oh, what do you think of this? And then doobity-doo. And then it takes us out of it and we're overthinking it, where it's like just run with it and we can listen to it afterwards and pick out the parts, much like you did with the long one. That's why I was asking if you've ever considered live streaming, because that's what we've done, is we cut out the different parts we like and then repurpose those in our own personal time and multi-tracking. Whereas with the live ones, we just record the live session. One, because then it's like, hey, it's a form of, like you said, it's marketing. It's probably the most easiest form of marketing because we're just playing live.
You're a live band.
And then with two, we can just then pick it apart and multi-track and try different sounds. But like the idea's out there. And also you're forced to go in a certain direction because it's live. Because you can't stop. I mean, we could stop. There's nobody telling us we can't, but you feel silly knowing people are watching going, oh, hold on a sec. Hold up. You know?
Yeah.
You think of it like being on stage, but I get both sides of it for sure.
A lot of like playing live for me, a lot of the decisions that I've made in a band context has been like, this part, we're just wasting people's times with. Maybe, you know, there is some trance inducing thing that gives it merit to just repeat yourself or whatever, or really be indulgent about it. But it's like, at the end of the day, I feel like whenever you're putting on a live show, that is a representation of you, like that somebody paid for. Now that's probably something that delineates it quite a bit, but that somebody paid for, you don't want to waste their time with your self-indulgence and stuff. Whereas with like a live stream and stuff, yeah, have at it. Mm-hmm. Musician PJ Harvey?
Oh yeah. Love PJ Harvey.
Yeah. She's one of my hugest inspirations. She did that installation where they made the Hope Six demolition project in a glass box for everybody to just walk in and watch them do their creative process with. And occasionally, you know, by the end of the day, you saw them do one song or two songs, like as they're kind of pounding them out and stuff. I think that's that's kind of a future wave sort of way of doing it. Cause like to invite the audience into the creative process, even if they don't have like an active role in it, they're still observing and they're still contributing in some way to it.
Yeah.
And it's a very vulnerable thing too, because like, I don't know, I feel like if you were to watch me for 8 hours working on tracks and stuff, you would be bored to tears because it's all just like setting levels. Oh, I got to get that saturation just right. Mm-hmm. Oh, when's the flange come in? Okay.
No, but there are some people out there that really are into that, you know, even just seeing the process, even just popping in, you know, The biggest part is, well, I guess with music, it's different. Like when I do live drawing streams, you have to keep talking. Because there's nothing else going on but you drawing. Sure, you can watch people draw, but it's like, I don't know, it's weird without audio, but or with music, play stuff.
You could try the ASMR thing where you mic up the paper real close and then...
That's actually a good point. I like, oh, wait, no, I draw digitally. I draw... So, you know, I guess you could hear my...
Your mouse.
Yeah, the sliding of the tablet. I don't know.
Yours just
sounded like it was like a quiet fart.
it's all art.
Yeah, that's true. You can't have art without fart. No, other way around. Either way, that joke didn't land. But now, getting back to more serious things. So you have your studio that you have. Is it at your home? Do you have a place where the studio is? Like, where is it located?
Yeah, it's just the basement. It's Oxford Road Basement Studios.
Right, which is ORBS, which I love that that's ORBS. The abbreviation of it.
I spent a lot more thought into that one than my band name.
When did you set it up?
Oh, it's been a growing process since we moved here, which is around a decade ago.
Okay.
We're in the process of buying the place. So
nice.
I'll definitely be like, well, I'm already nested. I'm not moving all this junk.
Yeah.
You know, cabling and It's just a nightmare, but it's mostly a in the box style recording thing, but we've got space to do live treatments and stuff, live amping. It's just not a very good drum sound.
Oh, I can see
it's
that.
It's a big concrete box, so there's no dialing back that slap back.
Mm-hmm. How do you have everything mic'd in? Like, what's your setup? Do you have just, is all of it connected to the sound card? I mean, are you just ready to go on whatever you choose to play?
Yeah, I've got two mixing boards that are just analog in stuff. They run into a Focusrite Scarlett 18i20. Mm-hmm. It's real rudimentary stuff. I've been thinking about upgrading, but it's like, you know, one thing at a time. I got to spend $5,000 on a synthesizer before I should upgrade my recording rig, right?
Priorities.
Yeah, right. Or priorities. But yeah, everything's routed into a patch bay. So, and I don't do a ton of like multi-track overdubs. Mm-hmm. I like to do things one thing at a time and get them right, get my texture right, and get my sound stage right.
Yeah.
So I'm usually working on drums and bass one day, and then I'll unpatch everything and start working on maybe vocals just to guide the song, and then I'll bust out the synths, and it's like, how am I feeling today? I'm feeling like a Selena day. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like plugging the Selena into a small stone phaser, like classic funk style, R&B sort of thing. Or I'm feeling like, you know, Acid World, and we're gonna run a 303 into a 808 and go to town.
Yeah.
So it's just how the mood strikes you. But everything is available to, you know, within a matter of minutes, you can plug any of this gear in, and
that's the best part. Yeah, being able to track, like, there's the whole thing of practicing, but our setup relies mostly on, if we got something, it's like, ooh, quick, push record. Like, we're all set up. Like, even though we're live in the room, we're also mic'd up to multi-track to the laptop that we have at the studio, and it can go at any time. That's also how we run our live setup. So everything is set to coincide with each other for us to be able to use it in whatever way we want. It's one of those things where you don't realize till you do it. It's like, oh my God, why have we not been doing this the whole time? Why is it like, okay, now let's set up for doing the thing we just worked on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Why didn't we just do it in the first place?
Exactly. Why weren't we just already set up?
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, for, if you're trying to make music off the cuff with, you know, tabla rasa, and you're all just there vibing with each other, that's mm-hmm. essential, because you never know when you're going to catch like just that perfect little riff, that perfect rhythm in there, and it's going to hit. And you might as well have it for posterity's sake. I mean, that is pretty cheap.
Yep.
These days. So
yeah, you're not wasting tape anymore.
Yeah, there's no tape getting cut up here. So,
well, and the other reason it's beneficial too is because what will happen is it'll be like, oh, I really like that guitar riff, we should get it down. Then you go set it up and it's like, all right, play that guitar riff. Oh, damn, I don't remember what I did. It's like, yeah.
No, voice memos and having a perpetual recording setup is like, that's the key, because mm-hmm. inspiration, it never strikes you whenever you want it to.
Yeah.
It's always when you're like waking up, or like you're two beers in at practice, mm-hmm. or like when you just want to go.
Yeah. Now, with the different instruments that you have and the different, I mean, you play different types of music. What, mm-hmm. I guess, what would be your process for when you decide to work on a project? Do you go, I'm going to play something in this genre of music now, or I'm going to work with these people to work on this album? Like, how do you decide what style you're going to work in?
Well, sometimes it's predetermined by who I'm working with. Cause, you know, there's been some times where I work with like a hip hop artist. There's a hip hop artist around here that does licensed music, or licensing, what, you know, the kind where you just make a bunch of music, and then like if a recording company or a movie set or something, they need some
right.
some music. They'll just
licensable
pull from it and be
music,
like,
yeah.
yes, that sort of thing. So he does that sort of thing. And I've worked with him and it's like, okay, I got to be in the mindset of like, you know, socially conscious rap. Mm-hmm. Or I work, you know, I've recently did a house album with a friend of mine and we were like, we need to limit ourselves to certain prompts or whatever. But like most of the time these days, like if I know what the mood of the song is going to be, I already have an idea of instrumentation. And I feel instrumentation is like the essential core aspect of most genre mm-hmm. in general. I've got guitars and basses and keyboards and pianos and all this good stuff. And I could just move to the paradigm that I need. Like when I'm doing funk music, I'm doing boogie music, you know, like I got a Prophet going on.
Yeah.
And I got an Oberheim playing it because that's what they used back then. And I've got an 808 drum machine or I've got something similar for that sound, a Linn drum for that sound specifically. Mm-hmm. But if I want to do folk music, you know, I got a sitar over here. I play the sitar, and I get the finger bells out and we're going, we're going flower power on it.
Yeah.
You know, so it's at the core of all of it is instrumentation. If I know what the song's going to be like lyrically, because I'm singing it, like songs flourish from a lot of songs just flourish from the way that you sing it.
Yeah.
So
and I'm trying to remember, there's one song you have when you said the folk song, and I'm sorry, I'm switching screens here so I can see it. Ah, The Time. There's a song that you have called The Time, which is a combination of sort of, when I first heard it, I'm like, okay, this is kind of, wait, no, it's not folksy, it's bluesy. And then the singing comes in and I'm like, no, this is like early Prince. This is like pre-controversy Prince. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a cool song and it was unexpected from what I knew of what I had played on the music show that I did. And I was enjoying that. That was an interesting song. Tell me about that album and how that came about. I really like that.
Okay, so I do have this softcore syndicate thing that is just this goofy funk boogie thing that I want to do.
Which is ironic because the song I found you on was called Gin Boogie and it's more of a industrial song.
Yeah, well, I mean, I contextualize it with words however you please.
Right.
But that album was Hontological Fallacies 1986. And it was called 86 because I used a Korg DW8000 keyboard mm-hmm. and a Korg DDD1 drum machine, which were kind of big in the boogie scenes back then. The DW8000 was like one of the last analog. It was kind of like a digital analog hybrid, kind of going along with the DX7, but it still had analog filters and all this cool stuff. And the DDD1, it's like the sound of New Jack.
Yeah.
You know, like Bobby Brown and stuff like that.
Right.
So it's like the New Jack drum machine. So that whole album was using that instrumentation primarily, just those two pieces. Mm-hmm. And I'd already had the idea for The Time for a softcore syndicate song. And I just fleshed it out with just that instrumentation because it's exactly the sound that I wanted. So, but I really wanted that lush kind of like, there's an artist out right now, Kay Trinata, that does just these gorgeous lush pads on everything or has like a really sweet kind of Oberheim style bass line on it. Mm-hmm. And that's purple to me. That's the purple sound.
Okay.
Because it harkens right back to Prince in The Time.
Yeah.
And the whole Star Company thing, Jesse Johnson, Apollonia 6, Vanity 6, all that group of musicians, they all kind of use that same instrumentation. And The Time was sort of a celebration of like the, like, oh, baby, I want to love you so bad, but I ain't got the time. So because the humor of Softcore Syndicate, I think, is pretty essential because, mm-hmm. I mean, I love that funk music and it is a essential part of me, but at the end of the day, I love it so much because it's so damn goofy.
Yeah.
Like it's so much fun. Yeah. That's kind of what The Time was about, was just a little introduction to that.
And I do enjoy the band The Time too, even when they went into the Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis phase when they did the Pandemonium album. That song Jerk Out is still a jam from that album.
Oh, dude, Jam and Lewis's productions are so phenomenal. Like, they did an album with SOS Band called Sands of Time that I think is like the Bible for R&B, modern R&B. And the stuff they did with Sherelle is so good. It's just so funky and just freaking perfect. And then they did like the stuff with Change. Have you heard Change?
Like, no.
Give me back all my love. I had a change of heart. It's it's so smooth. It's so good. It's probably all the same drum machine beat for every single song, but it's the perfect beat. It's the perfect 808 line.
Okay.
I don't know. I geek hard about that era of music because, like, Clear and Cameo and all those Imagination, those bands just really, really get me going and inspire me constantly. It's kind of at loggerheads with, you know, my background in more psychedelic music, but I do feel like, you know, those people were inspired by the same people 15, 20 years before who were making, you know, psychedelic folk and stuff. I mean, everybody was listening to records back then. It was like, you got a record collection. You're going to listen to the whole record collection because you bought it and it's real and it's in your hand. So I feel like it kind of had a little more importance back then because what else were you
going to do? It was also easier to leaf through too. Like, while I have a really big collection of stuff that I listen to, I always am going, I don't know what to listen to. And it's, you can't just scroll through everything. It takes forever. You start with the A's and then, you know, it's, by the time you get to the B's, you're like, all right, I'm just going to pick something from the B's.
I usually end up on Cocktail Twins.
Nice.
And that's it. I don't know, Can or Cocktail Twins. I'm not going through the rest of my collection here.
Oh, and, you know, God forbid they have the in front of their name, then they're never going to get played.
Yeah. Nope.
So with all the stuff that you're doing, before we go today, is there any projects that you're working on, things that you're planning to do that you'd like to tell people about?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, in the last year, I did a record with my friend Howie. It's called Dharmic Beams. Dharmic, like Dharmic, and then Beams, like Beams of Light.
Yeah.
And that was that house album I was talking about. I'm super proud of what we did with it. I mean, it's like a full on Boards of Canada style collaboration. Like, you know, we were a pair that were creating with the purest impulse, I feel like, for a lot of the stuff I've done. Like, just serving a song and like making it as cool as you could. And I'm really proud of it. I think it's some of the best stuff I've done recently. And then also I've got Softcore Syndicate. I put out an album last December and it's up online in the places. It's just called If It Ain't Enough, It's Too Much. Super proud of that record. Coming up here in the future, I'm going to do another Lovecraft release that's a little bit more like dark trip hop sort of stuff, but it's a song. It's an actual songy song with words and structure and stuff, and maybe make an EP out of that. And then I've got some more Softcore Syndicate in the works right now, even synthier, even funkier, even funnier, that I cannot wait to let the world hear. But, you know, I don't get myself out there that much. So it'll probably just sort of dissipate into the air, but that's fine because it's all about the process and it's all about the vibrations, you know?
Yeah. When you collaborate with other people, how do you go about that? Do they come to your studio and work on stuff or do you share it back and forth? Like, how are you doing that?
Most of it is remote. I mean, it's all online. So like I send him he sends me wave files. I send him an overdub. Most of the time that I've done it, I've had the privilege of being able to mix it myself because mixing and editing, and that's a big part of my process. And then they'll mix or they'll master it or I'll master it. We kind of delegate tasks and stuff.
But you're saying somebody will record a track and you'll export the stem and then the person will add it on their end? Like, what's the process for they did something? How do they get it back to you? They're working in Pro Tools too. Like,
I don't know. Some of them, you know, some of them do Studio One, some of them do Reason or whatever it is, Reaper.
Yeah.
But WAV files are the, you know, universal
right
tool.
So you'll just
me.
Send them a mix down and they'll play on top of it.
Yeah, or like, yeah, if I want an overdub from them, but that's kind of rare. I don't really like, you know, farm out. Like, if I want somebody to record something, they come here. Like, if it's a guitarist,
okay,
they come here and we set up a big old thing, or we'll be upstairs or downstairs.
That's what I was
whatever.
Wondering. Like, when you have somebody record a track for you, how do they go about doing it? That's what I was.
Yeah, thinking. Yeah, mostly guitar, vocal type stuff. That's all I want to record it, so I have full control over the sonic environment.
Okay.
But if I'm doing stuff for somebody else, yeah, I'll just send them a WAV file, pop it over there, make sure it's at the right level for them, and they could probably just slip it in without even needing to mix it.
Right.
Ideally, because I don't want them to miss a second of my magic. You know.
That was also borderline creepy the way you did that. Like, you seemed like an evil genius. Don't miss a second.
Yeah, I don't know. I try not to be a fascist about it. but I think sometimes I do come off a little fascistic with.
No, you don't. Now,
I know what I like.
Yeah. And if people wanted to check out your stuff, where should they go look for your music?
Lovecraft.bandcamp.com.
And that's craft just with an F, not a T.
Yeah, it's luvcraf.bandcamp.com. That's most of my personal output. And, you know, we're up on all the streaming services and Spotify and blah, 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 blah. Please check out my Reverb Nation page.
I actually looked that up the other day to see if it was still around. I had forgotten all about it, and it popped into my head. It's still there. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, pity the poor fools who are using that still. Or like MySpace music, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway,
it's a little antiquated, but.
Well, you know, Reverb Nation aside, I want to thank you very much for talking with me today. It was great meeting you. Well,
thank you. It was a pleasure meeting you too.